Thank you, everybody, for being here. I hope all of you, well, I'm sure all of you are interested in working with immigrants and refugees, and I commend you for your interest and your work. So today I'll be presenting about developing a typology of Latina sex workers in Baltimore, and there are no relationships to disclose. And here is a quick view of the agenda. We'll look at the background in terms of Latinos and HIV in the U.S. and Baltimore. Then we'll look at the research goal and objectives for the research that we're doing, theoretical framework, and then I will go into the current findings about the sex work typology, which is the meat of my presentation, and I hope you find interesting. Okay, in terms of the background, Latinos are disproportionately affected by HIV in the United States as in Baltimore. In the U.S., HIV prevalence among Latinos is 2.8 times higher than among non-Hispanic whites, and 54% of new infections occur among Latinos born outside of the United States. And in Baltimore, the AIDS cases have actually decreased among different ethnic groups, but among Latinos, they have actually doubled in the last year, from 40 to 80 cases per 100,000. And before I move forward, I want to talk very briefly about why we consider Baltimore a new receiving community. And Suzanne will expand on these in her presentation later. But in essence, Latinos have been coming to Baltimore in significant numbers. From 1990 until 2008, the Latino population has grown by almost 50%. And in 2011, Baltimore recorded for the first time in 50 years population growth. The population had actually been decreasing, and finally they recorded some growth, and most of it was attributable to Latinos coming into the city. So as you can see, we have a little bit of a challenge here. We have the Latino population growing, and at the same time, HIV among Latinos growing. So it's something that we thought we should start considering and addressing more proactively there, rather than waiting until it becomes an even worse problem and harder problem to deal with. So why did we decide to study sex work among immigrant Latinos? Well, there's very little information about this. And as you may know, if you work in the field of HIV and STI prevention, female sex workers are among the groups at highest risk of HIV infection and onward HIV transmission. In the recent study that was conducted in 2013 in low and middle income countries, the researchers determined that female sex workers have 13.5 higher odds of being living with HIV as compared to females of reproductive age. This, of course, is in low and middle income countries. In terms of what is the situation in the United States, we don't really know because there's very little research in this area. And one of the reasons, of course, is because sex work in the US, in most states, is illegal. So what we're trying to do with this research, qualitative research, is to fill this gap. So the research gaps, here are two bullet points about that. Latino immigrant community has a unique political, economic, and social position in the United States. And most recently, as you know, we've been on the news a little bit with Obama, with the new proposal. We'll see what happens with that. And there's very little information about the context and risk environment that faced by Latina immigrant female sex workers and their clients. And our research goal is to understand what is this risk environment, and of course, how can we intervene? And we need an in-depth understanding to intervene appropriately. The research objectives are in this slide, and today I'm going to focus on the progress that we've made on developing the typology of sex work in Baltimore. So in terms of the framework that we use this framework from Pitan and colleagues. They published this paper in 2013. And in essence, what they propose with this typology is that in order to understand HIV and STI risk, you not only need to focus on the venue type, but you also need to understand the macro level factors, which include local policies regarding sex work, stigma toward female sex workers. You also need to look at venue and micro-level factors, including condom availability at the venue, manager support for safer sex, also if there are any provisions for safety for the women, and finally individual-level factors such as age, education, and cost per sex act. So this is what we use as we explore the different types or modalities of sex work in Baltimore. Okay. And in terms of our current progress, we've conducted ethnographic observation. We've gone to various bars with our partners in the research. And we've also conducted unstructured interviews and conversations. A total of six in-depth interviews with female sex workers, with interviews with 10 clients, three key informants, and our goal is to increase the numbers to 15 interviews with 15 female sex workers, 20 clients, and interviews with 10 key informants. And so that you know, in terms of who are our key informants, it's mostly people who are managing some of these venues, people who are passing around information about the services provided, and people who somehow are working in the industry. Okay, so this is the meat of my presentation, and these are the seven types of venues or modalities of sex work that we found in Baltimore. So I will start with the one that I think we probably could say where there's the least risk, HIV risk, and that would be independent and casual workers. So in this type of venue or modality, I should say, there's not really a middleman or pimp. So the women get to keep most of their earnings. They work on an as-needed basis. And what they're doing is they're supplementing their income. So usually they're already working in a bar or at a factory. They're making very low wages, around $7. Some reported $7 an hour, more or less. And they really don't get access to some of the higher paying jobs, which are often in construction, and those tend to pay $10 or $12 an hour. So when there's an urgent need or an emergency back home or even here, with some of them have their children here, they do these extra work on the side, if you will. And usually how it works is that men will call them, and then they go to their houses, and these are usually houses with many men. So in terms of safety, they often feel safe because there are other men in the other rooms around. So if there's a need to, you know, yell for help, they can do that. And from the three women that work under this modality that we interviewed, two of them said that they felt very safe, and one of them actually reported rape. So in terms of safety, you know, it's a bit of a mixed bag, if you will. And in terms of how they meet the men, their clients, they usually meet them at bars or at restaurants or at bus stops. And one of the clients actually reported that there seems to be some kind of informal understanding in terms of how they communicate. And the guy said that, you know, we asked him, you know, how do you know that it's a sex worker? How do you know that it's a woman who's not working in sex work? And he said, well, you know, they give you the eye. So once they give you the eye, you know. And we tried to figure out how to make the eye, but I please don't ask me to do that, because it was actually kind of difficult. I couldn't do it. but yeah, so there is this informal dance that they know how to navigate, and there is this informal kind of communication that they have, and they know how to recognize each other. The women who talked to us, they said that this is a very common type of sex work, that most of their friends are doing it, and they hear also that women that they didn't know were engaged in this kind of work are engaging in this kind of work. They report consistent condom use. They said that that's very important to them because they're conscious that condom use is important to protect their health. And in general, the women that we talked to saw this as a way of financial empowerment. they saw this as a choice. They were really not thinking about relationships with men here as a source of, you know, sense, you know, love or something that maybe they looked for when they were back in their home countries. Their sense of having moved to the United States very much one where they're looking to increase their income and support for their family. So the other two typologies, so this is, we characterize this as delivery service because the women will go to the men's house. The other two types are the house and trucks. And the houses are houses that are rotating. They're hired by, the owners are usually people in New York, Virginia, Maryland, New Jersey. It seems that there's some connection with gangs and organized crime, but we really didn't get that story too straight, or we didn't dig that too deeply either. There's a middleman, so the fees are shared between the women and the middleman. And usually there are two or three girls in each house for the weekend, and then they move on. There seems to be some trafficking happening at those places. We couldn't really get to talk to some of the women that allegedly have been trafficked because of safety concerns, and you know it's hard to actually get to the house. But an important thing to point here is that, you know, it's important not to conflate trafficking with sex work. As we just heard, the women who are doing this independently, they are very empowered and are doing this at a financial, you know, the way of getting financial resources, where some, not all of the women in the houses, some of them may be trafficked. And it seems that some of them are trafficked, you know, by coyotes helping them to cross the border, and sex work is a way for them to pay their debt. And some of them are actually, once they pay their debt, they're dumped, they're drugged and they're dumped in some, in the place in the city. But, you know, this is information that we need to find more participants to get more details. Okay, so in terms of the truck, it seems to be someone connected to the house, and it's a guy who's driving around in the city with sometimes with the women in the truck, and they're giving advertisements about sexual services. Then the other three types are bar workers, who are usually women who are serving drinks at bars, and then men usually pay for different levels of touching the women and also dancing. And when they buy drinks for the women, they have to pay more money for the drinks that they buy for the bar workers. So the owner of the bar worker is not getting a cut of the sexual fee, I suppose, but more of the, you know, money coming from the drinks. It seemed the environment seemed insecure because in some cases women they, you know, pretend that they want to go with a particular client, but they don't follow through, and then and there were cases where the client was waiting for them outside, and you know they beat them down, they beat them up, and things like that. In terms of street-based, these women are actually working independently. They and most of them seem to have substance abuse problems, especially cocaine and heroin. And they work independently, and it seems that they somehow are in the vicinity of each other, so they kind of take care of each other, but they do report violence. And then finally, online, women work independently and sometimes with a pimp, and the websites that you're using are just, you know, the common social websites that we use, but they use it to find clients. And in terms of common risk factors, what I wanted to highlight from here would be the fee. It really varies a lot among the women, and also in terms of whether they keep the whole amount or they share it with the pimp. So in terms of, you know, economic empowerment, that varies too. But the fee for the street-based women was the lowest among all of the ones where we got information. They charge about $30 per service. And then the fee can go as high as $100, $400. And then really quickly, before my time is over, our lessons learned. In terms of recruitment, one thing that really helped us was that the outreach workers and the researchers had established community relations. So there were, even before this research started, there were years of working with the community. People knew who they were, and that really helped, especially with this topic, and especially with Latinos, because Latinos are not really used to having people doing research among them. So they, you know, it's a new thing. And there's a, and given also their status, many of them are undocumented, there's a little bit of trust challenges that you have to overcome. And also something that helped tremendously was having a flexibility with the schedule. So sometimes they would call and say, you know, I'm ready to for the interview right now, and then you just have to drop everything and go meet them, because if you make an appointment, as usually it's hard to make sure that, you know, you find the person where they say they could be, because sometimes their lives, you know, tend to be in flux. They really need to work when they, you know, have to work, and they will rather go and work than skip the work and lose their wages. And then finally, another thing that worked very well was providing fair incentives. Okay, so it looks like my time is over, but in terms of additional considerations, just, you know, ask me during the Q&A session. I just want to thank all the contributors of this research, Suzanne here in the panel, one of them, and then especially the Baltimore City Health Department, Latino Outreach, which has been instrumental in the research. So thank you very much.